We'd like to thank our patron supporters for sponsoring this episode. The Witch of Wandering Dreams, Pamela, Josie the Mountain Troll, and Billy, a Witch of the Lower Green Swamp. Thank you all so much.
You're listening to Southern Bramble, a podcast of crooked ways. I'm Marshall, the Witch of Southern Light.
And it's a little bag made from the skin of a toad, Austin, Bane X Bramble. And today we have a wonderful and dear and special guest with us. Everybody, please welcome Nick Dickinson. She is the headmistress of the Circe Academy of Witchcraft through the Cauldron Black in Salem, Mass, and a professional witch and witchcraft educator for over 35 years, with experience working with clients and students in both public and private settings. Ordained and initiated in a variety of Mahayana Buddhist tantric yoga traditions, and a teacher of thousands of teachers, yogas, and psychics. His classes and workshops are deeply influenced by the intersection of classical yoga theory and modern witchcraft practice. Operating through a multidimensional animist lens with a focus on Greek folklore, Nick's content welcomes all traditions at all levels and can be approached in a purely secular way. Nick, thank you for that lovely introduction. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you for having me here. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, because we have a subject that is very dear to me, and I would say dearer even to you. But I think that we'll have a gorgeous time chitty chatting about it.
I'm sure we will.
I'm really excited because, as I told you yesterday, the closest exposure that I've had to Circe from the Greek myths, of course, is Bernadette Peters in the made-for-TV Odysseus. And it's my absolute favorite, with her huge, extremely tight, springy red curls and her made-for-TV gossamer gown. And she's like, "I'll help you if you take me to bed." And like, you know that voice, "If you take me to bed." And she says it in this way that I'm just like, okay, this is the stage, this is the screen, this is the majestic Bernadette Peters. Circe, yes, please, and thank you.
So good. So good.
Before we get into it, I have a question for you, and it's not on our brief, and I'm throwing it to you as a curveball. Have you read the new Circe novel? I can't remember her name. And do you like it? And how do you feel about it?
This is it. Margaret Miller.
Yes.
This book has been part of my ritual practice. So I did a ritual to Circe at the first Salem Witchcraft and Folklore Festival. And that book was with us as a living folklore, Circe being retold again, Circe reappearing in art again.
Gorgina, I love that. That's very exciting.
I recommend it. I brought some props, and that was one of the props, is like, if you haven't read Circe by Madeline Miller, read it. Definitely.
That I'm glad I asked. Before we get into Circe, I was wondering if you could tell us, because we've known each other for maybe a few years or so, but I don't think we've ever like sat down and talked to like how did you get here? I mean, you have such a history in, like I said, multiple traditions, particularly in yoga and things like that. So can you tell us your origin story?
I can. And at the risk of leaning into the blood witch, a witch blood discourse that's happening at the moment, I think we have to start with my conception, because my mom was a witch. Do you know who Louise Hubner is? Power Through Witchcraft, Seduction Through Witchcraft, The Official Witch of LA. Oh,
No, but I'm
Marshall.
going to now.
Oh, you're gonna love this. This is my
Okay.
gift to
Please, I'm ready.
you. So Louise Hubner was the first and only officially recognized witch by a government in the United States or by any government in the world. She was the official witch of LA, and she wrote a book called Power Through Witchcraft.
I
And
recognize
my mom
this.
had
I recognize this cover. Yes, the
that.
acid green, French
I
green
mean,
cover.
her album is on Spotify. It's called Seduction Through Witchcraft. It's worth the listen. It's sort of a psychedelic journey into her witchcraft theory. And my mom had her book. And when I was a tween, maybe it was like 10 or 11, I found her book hidden in her room. And it had the notes to the love spell that she put on my father when they were 18.
That's so
They had
funny.
me. She
Real.
had me when she was 19. This was 1972, I'm not ashamed to say.
Wow.
And the notes were really specific. His name, and it was a spell that I think it's called, I can't remember the name of the spell, but I have the book, I can look it up. It's use playing cards in a circle of salt to create the future that you want. It's quite an ingenious spell. I've used it to much devastation in my life.
Wonderful.
And my mother, she got what she wanted. She was like, this a Greek, a child of immigrants, kind of like a nerd, and she got the quarterback of the football team, and he got her pregnant, and that baby is me.
Good for you.
So I'm a Louise Hubner love spell baby. So my origin is witchcraft. It's like that has been part of my awareness since I was obviously a young kid. But that book was my first witchcraft book because I stole it from my mother and I started doing spells from it before she even realized. And then when she realized it, she started taking me to like, we would go to Salem and see Laurie Cabot. We would like go to New Age sort of things. And that's how I started in witchcraft. It was already there. And my grandmother was practicing a form of Greek Orthodox folk magic. She would not consider herself a witch. She is still going to the Greek Orthodox Church. But we were, practicing getting rid of the evil eye for like people in the community. So people from the Greek community in Lowell and where I grew up is the border of New Hampshire here, would like even come to our house for her to do the blessings. So like witchcraft was already there. And then of course I got to do whatever I wanted. My mom would take me to any teacher, any lecture, get me any book that I wanted. So my studies started really there. And that continued. I was, reading cards through high school. I got a job reading cards. It was one of my first paying jobs. And then when I graduated high school, I started reading cards in college. And so we would have like keg parties and pay our rent. People would just come one in after the other, and I would read cards. And my sort of witchcraft interest started with Louise Hebner, but then it was like Starhawk, Scott Cunningham, like what I had access to at the local shops in New England. You can imagine what that was like in the 80s. I got into Egyptian ceremonial magic around that time, which was, very trendy. And there's still parts of that, sort of stuck with me as they do. And then in 1994, I dropped out of college and joined a religious order. I ordained as a Buddhist monk with a Tibetan tradition. And mainly because everything that sort of I was interested in witchcraft is also happening in Mahayana tantric Buddhism, but it's living lineages. You can get initiation, people can teach you about this is how you work with the spirit exactly. This is how you make the offerings to the spirit exactly. And so I got initiated in a bunch of that stuff. And I worked for that organization for a long time. I was the ritual arts director for the Northeast Coast, or sorry, the East Coast completely, but I was based in the North. And I would have probably stayed with them, except that like I started getting this sort of feeling of bumping up against a religious organization as a witch. You know what I mean? They were starting to sort of strip more of the sort of ritual stuff that I liked out of it and making it very, very mainstream. And there's nothing wrong with it. They are still an organization that does very mainstream Buddhism, but it wasn't for me. And so I started teaching mainstream yoga, and for a while I was like teaching and running the two biggest mainstream yoga studios in Boston and in Cambridge here. And during that period, I taught people how to teach yoga, how to teach meditation. And it was all sort of overlapping. And the CEO of the company at the time found out I was reading cards, and then being a psychic suddenly like bled into the yoga world. And I came like full circle again, and ended up back at the Cauldron Black teaching in a witchcraft setting in 2018, I think it was. Does that make sense? Does that bring up more questions?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Where this is a Cauldron Black Stan account. So very, very happy. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I just wanted to add context for, like, because we'll definitely at least mention a little bit about the witchcraft yoga that you've taught, which is like really cool. And embedding like this background of like, no, again, this is rooted within traditions, initiatory traditions, and also like how all of those things can coexist within witchcraft, because like the witch will grab whatever she can, whatever power source she can, and implement it into her tool bag. And so I think that's really fabulous. So today we're talking about Circe. You'll have to forgive me, I will probably say Kirke a lot, it doesn't always happen, but like for some reason Kirke just got lost to the Romanized spelling for me, so I always say Kirke often and spell it that way. Circe Kirke. I'm wondering if you could tell us about who Kirke is for those who may not know, or may not know her as well. I feel like she's a pretty enigmatic popular figure, but or infamous popular figure, but can you tell us about her role in mythology and who she is?
Yeah, so technically she's a titan or a titaness. She's the daughter of Helios, the sun, and a figure called Perse, the oldest version of her story anyway. But the word Perse is super interesting because it just means like Persian goddess. The same syllables make up the name Persephone. So there's this, it's like, it has the same, like, I think if I'm not mistaken, some of the stabs at translation we don't really know are like wrathful one, like it almost sounds like, or dark goddess, for lack of a better term. I kind of cringe at that term. But it has that suggestion that there's like a danger there. There's like a witchy underworld danger. But Perse was an oceanid. She was part of the ocean. In Circe Academy, we honor Perse as being the most beautiful part of the ocean, because when you think about like, where does the sun touch the ocean? You know, that's mesmerized human beings for millennia, right? How much art comes from like the seashore where the sun is touching the sea. And so my sort of multi-animist take on this is that where the sun hits the sea, that's what produces Circe or Kirki, or, you know, or Titania Circe, as I call her. And if you think about what happens in that that relationship between the sun and the sea, it produces rain. It produces fresh water that then produces medicinal flora. It's literal that Circe is medicinal flora. She's the magic of medicinal flora. So she is, in Homer, in the original source material, witchcraft itself on some level, the process of transmutational and protective energy. It's worth pointing out that she shows up in Homer and her appearance is not only the first written account of any kind of witchcraft, it's also... the fact that it's Homer means that we can infer it's a very, very old story. So we don't even know who Homer really was. We're not sure if like Homer was a one person or many people. Like when Homer was writing, he was writing about a time period that was mythological to him. That civilization had disappeared. You know, if you think about like the ruins of Pylos. Yeah. So it's like us writing about Atlantis. Like there's no evidence. We can only speculate.
Sorry to cut you off, but like him codifying the myth of the Iliad, it had already been an old story by the time that he's documenting it, which is crazy, right? So yeah, it's already old, and even just his terminology of like a wine-colored sea being like that infers also how old it is by like not using certain terms, by choosing to call the water wine colored as opposed to another color. Sorry to cut you off. I love this shit. Go ahead.
It's really fascinating that I can't talk about it enough because it's similar to like the Yoga Sutras. This is how it comes back to yoga, and it all overlaps for me. The oldest written Yoga Sutras are the Rig Veda, and the Rig Veda was an orally transmitted text for thousands of years. We don't know how many thousands of years. We only know when they wrote it down. So is it 10,000 years old? Maybe. And Homer is very similar. It's not like that people were writing ancient Greek a lot. They weren't. They were speaking it. Things were orally memorized. So he was taking all these folk tales, weaving them all together in really what was a Marvel comic. You get why that's the case, right? Like, this is entertainment. Oh, yeah, this is entertainment. It's not religion. Homer's not religion. Homer was entertainment for the masses. So we have, when we look at the version of Circe, we have to put it in that framework that she's showing up as like the Scarlet Witch would for us today, or something like that. Like, there's folklore behind it, right?
Bringing
But
it
we
back
have to
to
be
chicken and
careful about that.
eggs.
Right. So her appearance is very fascinating, and this is, and tell me if I'm saying too much, feel free to interrupt, but this is, for me, the what inspired bringing Titania Circe through at the Witch House at the Forest Folklore Festival. It was as a, I was trying to bring her forth as a queer trans savioress. And the reason for that is she's queer and trans. She's queer and trans in the original source material. And it's really obvious to the original culture. So you have to do some study because reading Homer right now, we don't have the cultural context. It's not the same. But when Odysseus's men notice that there's some smoke in the woods, they start heading towards it because they think there's got to be someone there that can take care of us. Maybe there's food, maybe there's resources. So they start going into into the forest, and as they approach Circe, they don't see her. They hear her first, and she's singing. Now, to the ancient Greeks, a lady singing was culturally unacceptable. Only men sang, especially in public. It was considered very manlike to be singing. So that when they approach, it's important to like to set the scene. If this was a movie that was well done on the source material, this is a horror movie. When they hear her singing, they're like, something's not right. This is not a human being. And they can hear her weaving on a loom, and it's very melodic. So it almost sound like it almost feels sexual, right? You hear the thump thump, and she's singing thump thump. You know, there's this really like dramatic scene. Can you see? And they're like, what is this? And they call her Dread Goddess. There's a Dread Goddess up there with a human voice. This is a really important point. The reason why she's horrifying is because weaving is a female task, singing is a male task. She's doing them both. They know she's a Dread Goddess somehow in their awareness, but she has a human voice. She's neither human nor God. She's neither male nor female. She's occupying this very queer, very trans space. And Homer was telling us something, I think. He was telling us that witchcraft itself occupies that queer trans space. It is the nature of queer trans mutational energy. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
So I think, the most important thing to presence about Circe. And of course, I think most people know those guys end up as pigs eventually. And Odysseus comes to stay with her, and they have quite a long history after that. But she is, in the original source material, witchcraft itself.
Yeah, so this is even really before the word which gets codified in the English language. So one thing that I wanted to bring up, and this isn't in our brief either, so I'm throwing another curveball at you, but I know we we kind of wanted to touch on this, again, using these terms really before the word witch is codified in the English language and has a specific meaning, right? I think that people within the contemporary English language forget that witch is actually quite a new word. It's only a couple of hundred years old. And before we just throw the chalk this all up to bad sorcery or evil sorcery, even though I think that that can certainly be what's influencing the word, I want to touch on the terms rhizomoi and pharmakoi or pharmacist within the context of the ancient Greek language. I think most people, at least in the witchcraft world, are relatively familiar that like pharmacist means a druggist or somebody who works with poisons. And shout out to all the Hecate girlies out
A
here.
druggist pusher.
A drug pusher, even Katie, I push drugs. And then also too the which I don't know if Kirke gets the rhizomoi title kind of thrown onto her, but I know Medea does as this she like a cutter of roots, so rhizome and somebody who works with these roots, and therefore having this knowledge of plants both in a drug context and also being able to not only work with the plants but being able to identify them and know that this is the plant that we need to use. So yeah, I was wondering if you could go into that. That's not a
I
question,
can.
but
I very much can. Yeah, this is my favorite, deepest rabbit hole to go down. And even after, I first encountered Circe when I was like 12, 11, 12, out of one of these books from that you could order online from an 800 number.
Oh God,
That
the Wizard
was
and Witches books
like
are iconic. Yes.
Yes.
And I never paid for it. My mom was like, "What are you doing?" And I was just ordering them to show up to the house and stealing them. But yeah, the word pharmacy comes from the Greek, and it's Circe. It's fun, what my main epithet, the epithet that we start with when we chant to Circe is pharmakia. We say io Titania Circe pharmakia. Pharmakas or pharmakis is the original word for witch in the ancient Greek language. Like that, it just would have been understood that that's what she does. When Hermes protects Odysseus, he gives him the plant moly, which we don't know exactly what moly is, but there's a suggestion that it's the root part that is the important part. But in some of the artwork, it seems like he gave him the whole plant. And this is super duper interesting to me because it's an antidote to Circe's poison. She's the original poisoner. She gives, well, I don't know. Let's talk about that for a second, because what's the difference between poison and medicine? She gives, they come, Odysseus's men come in, she feeds them, she gives them what it sounds like it was like a salad, like it sounds like cottage cheese and wine and herbs and maybe some sliced up roots in there, and who knows, and some flowers maybe. And they eat it gleefully, and she raises a wand and she says some words and they turn into pigs. And in a lot of the ancient artwork, if you look at my most recent post on Instagram, there's a cup. Circe is standing there naked, poisoning them. It's really quite interesting. And they're just lining up to drink it. And one after another, she's turning them into pigs. She never harms them once they're pigs. She doesn't feed the pigs to her lions. She doesn't chop them up and make them into dinner. When Odysseus confronts her, she turns them back. And this is a very interesting point that often gets left out in the modern retelling. When Circe, this is in the original Homer, when Circe turns Odysseus's men back, they are healed. All their scars are gone. So we have to put the context of when they arrive at Circe's island. They're lost. They're lost at sea. They've had the shit beat out of them. They have all these war scars. They have battle injuries. And when she turns them into pigs and back again, they're healed, because the pig in ancient Greek folklore and even in ancient Greek mainstream Hellenic religion, The Eleusinian Mysteries come to mind, Demeter, Hecate, Persephone. The pig was a purifying animal. It wasn't considered dirty back then. It was a pure, it was like the blood of a pig was actually pure. So to the ancient Greek, hearing this story being sung or told or whatever, they'd be like, oh, she purified them of their scars. She made them well again. And Odysseus is the only one that doesn't get that treatment. So, and he, and his story, you know, obviously goes tragically wrong. We get infer that it's because he avoids her blessing on some level. So that act of poisoning is queer and heretical for a number of reasons. It would have been like a horror story, like a horror movie, because it breaks the rules of hospitality culture in the ancient Greek world. Like taking in strangers and taking care of them was important to the Greek people. So the fact that she poisons them is horrible. But then when they're healed, when they're turned back, the reader or the observer is to say, oh, well, that actually was a good thing ultimately. And we don't know exactly what she poisons them with, but there's been a lot of speculation over the years. Probably the roots that she had available would have been, you know, mandrake and other obvious stuff from the Mediterranean region. Something that I don't think gets included much is Nymphaea cerulea. Do you know Nymphaea? You've heard of that? It's blue, ancient blue, ancient Egyptian blue water lily. It's sometimes called blue lotus, but that's a mistake because lotuses sit on the surface of the water. Nymphaea comes up. It's a totally different plant.
Yes.
It's very popular in modern poison path culture. People like smoking it actually doesn't do very much. You have to put it into a salve really for it to do much. But there's some speculation that that would have been part of it, and that plant will also have inspired the Land of the Lotus Eater story, that it makes people forget. So them becoming pigs is they're forgetting their human problems. You know, they're allowed to just let all the human pain and trauma that they've experienced just melt away. They literally forget themselves. And that suggests all these different narcotics, right? Even opium makes people forget. So that act associated with Circe, and especially the fact that like it seems like cheating is very witchy. It seems like cheating. That's why she's horrifying. She's not using her own power as a goddess. She's taking power from the roots, and those roots are the blood of slain titans. It's the titans that fell, that Zeus fell. So it's necromancy. It's necromancy and witchcraft at the same. It's and poisoning at the same time. You want to say something?
Yes. Yeah. No. No. You're so fine. It gets me really excited because. So this goes back, of course, into the Rhizomoi and the pharmacist and all of those things. And one of my favorite descriptions, which is why I think the inference that the drug that Circe uses is absolutely mandrake, and I'm sure she's throwing other things in there as well. But because of in the Argonautica talks about the Promethean charm, which Medea uses to protect Jason. And this Promethean charm is the fallen bile or the fallen blood from Prometheus, the Titan. And when it falls to Earth, this root springs up, which leads into the other mandrake roots, that it's the blood or the semen from Galliman, and things like that by the time that it's getting in more northern Europe. And I think that it would be good here to remind ourselves that like mandrake is a Mediterranean plant. It does not grow very kindly in Europe, in England and things like that, where it would have been very hard to come by. It's not even that common apparently in the like Greek or anything like that, but it is suitable for that, better for that arid climate. And I just like to throw that out there because I think that people forget that it is not really a British plant by any means. And so it already has this fetishism that's going on, this othering that comes from the Greek place that it's originating from. But anyways, so It also says that it screams when it's pulled up from the root, and so I'm sorry, Medea has to make all these supplications to Hecate, do all these very specific ritual actions and gestures to make sure that when she pulls the root up, it doesn't that it doesn't offend the goddess and or scream and so on and so forth. Then when she cuts into it, it leaches this black blood, and it has the flesh of a man. And so all of those things right there really lead me and many others to believe that, okay, yeah, we're talking about Mandrake here, right? And two, if I think about my experiences with Mandrake, as a plant and ingesting it, which I don't recommend for legal reasons, ingesting the tincture with other plants, I find very, I mean, first of all, it'll make you shit your brains out. The TMI, but I mean, like after that, there is this purifying that comes with it, especially if you take it with another laxative and diuretic, such as rose water and things like that, which also causes bowel movements and things like that. So there is this purification aspect to it. And also the actionable part of the plant is that it makes you sweat. It is a very hot plant. At least for me, I know for, maybe for some other people, it can be a very cold plant, especially with the atropines. But for me, it's a very dancey plant. It likes to sit underneath the skin. It's very, very blood heavy. So all of those things, I'm like, yes, I can definitely see how this plant becomes very important to Circe and purifying to the men that she's giving it to. It's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, and I think you pointed out something that is not obvious and I don't see being talked about, which is that when we see Mandrake in British Isles lore, it's a reference to Greek witches. It's
And
a
drawing down the
reference
moon
to,
and drawing.
and that's Greek witches. So we can't really, when people are like, oh, I once got into something online, I won't mention any names. Someone was like, Circe has no influence in British Isles witchcraft. And that's absurd. Like no one has stopped talking about Circe. People have, before Homer were talking about her, during Homer were talking about her, but then people were writing her about her in the 1100s and the 1400s and the 1600s. It never stopped. The Shakespearean character of Titania is Circe. It's still the same goddess or power or whatever you want to call it, titanic force that we're talking about. And it originates with her. And I think that's super duper interesting because it says something about the action itself. She's not a witch because other gods, this is important to point out, I haven't said this in other places, other gods turn people into stuff, right? Like other gods, Athena, now you're a Gorgon, whatever, now you're a spider. But they do it through their own power. Circe is vampiric. She's the original vampire witch. She's taken this necromantic blood from the Titans and she's wielding it. It's not her own power. It's non-normative, queer, trans, mutational energy. Does that make sense?
I love
Well,
that.
and it kind of speaks to what we all do. We are channeling that power through herbs, through symbols, through power sources that we're tapping into, making contracts with, calling down, evoking, invoking. I'm a huge when you said that the roots are the blood of the Titans, like I'm a huge fan of plant lore itself. I think the idea of as an animist seeing a plant as a spirit and it having its own story, its own history, the magic that you associate with it isn't always just the doctrine of si signatures. Sometimes it's because it has its own lore. I didn't know that about the blood of the Titans. That's really fucking cool. So it makes me really, really excited about some other things that I've been working on. So please let's keep going because I'm excited.
Can I say one more thing just before
Please.
I lose it from my mind? That even though I make fun of occasionally, and I'm a little bit, what is the word, spicy online about like modern witchcraft Facebook groups and things like that,
Oh, yeah.
the magic that is mostly being proposed is still the Circe blueprint. Like people will be like, you know, go to the dollar store, get some lavender, put it in a red pouch and carry it in your pocket. That's Hermes giving instruction to Odysseus. Just carry this in your pocket. And the power, it's the same thing. It's like this, she's, what's weird about Circe for me, what the whole past 10 years of like examining this work publicly has sort of exposed to me is like, she's already there. People are like, oh, I don't have a relationship with Circe or I don't work with Circe. And I'm like, you actually do. If you're doing plant magic, you do actually. It's not, she's not some foreign entity that you're bringing into your life. She is the witchcraft narrative. It hasn't stopped.
Mm-hmm. She's the original witch in the woods.
She is, literally.
On her cottage, on her closed up island. I want to talk about, we've spent a lot of time on Odysseus, of course, but she, at least to my mind, and correct me if I'm wrong, she has more popular myths that maybe I just am not aware of because I'm so zoned in on these. But I think the other two myths that she's mostly known for is, of course, her role in the Iliad of transforming Odysseus's men into pigs and Odysseus's love affair, of course. But then the other two are her making the monster Scylla or Scylla, that shows up later in the Odyssey, her later myth in the Argonautica of her purifying Jason and Medea. I think those are her three most popular, but also going more into the purifications that we can certainly talk about. But one of my favorite things, and one that we've definitely talked about before and have really, I think, like solidified a friendship in, is our love of this myth of the scorning of Circe by Glaucus, the shimmering one, and her basically being like, well, screw you. I love you too much to actually hurt you. So I'm just going to transform the person you have your eye on into a bitch hound from hell. And I love this. I love this story. And I wonder if you could talk about the myth and then also how this shows up through your own witchcraft going forward.
I obviously love this story, and I talk about it even publicly. I got into it with one of our esteemed and beloved colleagues online a long time ago, and in a very playful way, because I posted Scylla deserved it. Did you see that?
I remember that.
And it was being playful, but also like, when we talk about it, you might find that maybe Scylla didn't deserve it, actually. And maybe vengeance isn't always wrong. And maybe vengeance is in itself a pleasure that we shouldn't deny ourselves, because normative society says you shouldn't enjoy putting other people in pain or whatever. But first, can I ask a question? Do you know why Scylla scorned Glaucus?
Oh, no, but I think it's because he was ugly, wasn't it? He, in the myths, he's usually depicted as a fish, as a man that is also a fish, part, like, not even in a sexy mermaid way, but like, he also smells like a fish and he has scales all over his body from being a fisherman in his past life before he is deified, right?
That's right. She scorns him because he's fishy in the original stuff. But that is because, so one way we can look at this is he's neither human nor God. He's neither a fish nor a man. He's something in between. He's something queer. He's something trans, actually. So maybe Scylla is a cishet. Do you see what I'm going? Where I'm
yeah,
going?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. hashtag Glaucus as the OG trans mask.
Yeah, Scylla could be a turf or something. Do you know what I mean? There's something in Circe's revenge that's like, I'll show you what it's like to be fishy. You know, I'll show him what she really is. That she's a bitch with a, how much can I say? This is, this is going to be public.
No,
he changes Scylla's vagina into barking rabid dog heads. You know what I mean? It's really graphic stuff. So.
Yeah, and you even have like corrected me before on the, of course, because the myth, the translations into English, which of course the majority of them come, oh baby, the myths that are being translated in English mainly come through the 1800s, the mid to late 1800s, where they probably wouldn't have said vagina. So the inference that they're talking about is her loins. And of course, in my mind, the loins are the inner part of the thigh, which of course is sexual enough for me anyways, because I'm darling and Puritan. But you had reminded me, or like, no, they're talking about not just the fact that her legs get transformed into dogs or into fish, but that like, her pussy is getting turned into a monster, which I think is really a good reminder. So thank you for that. That was like about a year ago, I think.
There was a woman who recently retranslated like the original Odyssey. Wasn't that, I feel like this was very recent, and
it
she
was,
found
yeah.
that there were so many slight and minute changes that because it was always translated by men before, they instilled a lot of very, very, very specific misogynistic aspects of their perspective in the writing and that translation. So when she did it, she found that there were a lot of little things that actually changed very specific details of the story. Is this one of them, you think?
I don't know that work, but it could be. I mean,
okay.
The word skila in Greece means bitch, but when Greek speaking people say it, it's like bitch cunt. Do you know what I mean? Like it's really like it's not nice. It's
yeah.
like the, you know you're.
It's an insult. It's an insult.
It's a literal curse. It's a literal curse. So, and when you think about like the history of Greek curse working, I'm thinking of like Greek magical papyri and stuff like that. It's a very poetic curse. You know, to make her into this monster, you know, whether you see Circe as jealous of what's happening or whatever, the poetics of it are inspiring. I think that like we can't even separate that as a originator of a lot of other ideas around cursing and transmutation and all of that stuff. But I think one of the things that I'm drawn to about Circe, and one of the things that made me so devoted to her from a very young age, is that she's a goddess of unconditional vengeance. You know, and that's also witchcraft. I mean, and how many stories from how many different cultures does the witch come in to give some form of vengeance or justice or retribution? And that's been her role. She's there, she's in it. And I have a class, it's in the archives, I'm going to teach again this year, where we actually use the Scylla curse on people who deserve it.
Yeah, and you had graciously shared that with me, and I think because at the time I was also working on a Scylla curse as well. And so there were so, interestingly, so many overlaps in what we were doing that we hadn't even talked about previously. And then when I got the opportunity to watch your class on it, I was like, oh my God. I won't give too much away. I think people should go watch the class. It was a really great, great thing. But yes, it is very poetic, right? Even in the PGM, it's talking about, you know, even in the myth that I'm thinking of that I'm pulling from my mind, it's like rage filled the goddess's heart. You know, it talks about her walking on water over to where Scylla is bathing and mixing her demonic herbs and chanting her spells nine times thricely. And I think it's, yes, Circe Invidiosa, which is such an important, I mean, image from the Tashin, it's a water house, right? And printed on the Tashin books on witchcraft. But yes, this like neon green bath that's like being poured into Scylla's tide pool, and you can see the monster being made underneath of her. It's really, really fabulous and fantastic. I think it's definitely a nasty curse, and I think the results are really interesting. how it is a curse, but I think it shows up in a lot of ways of like allowing people to see publicly the monsters that the person the curse is being inflicted on really is. So it isn't just like, oh, I'm going to turn you into something ugly, but it's like, I'm going to turn you into something ugly, and then your int the entirety of your character is going to be defamed because of it. And it's gorgeous.
And it was the first image of Cersei that I saw. This is the new Tashen book. I think it's so fascinating that, this came out, I think, in the second year of Cersei Academy. And if you don't have this book, it's amazing. Many of our esteemed colleagues are published here. But they just wrote the word witchcraft across Cersei poisoning the waters. And you can even see Cilla under there writhing. And Cersei is standing on the water. And I first saw that image in the earlier book that I showed you, that Wizards and Witches book. Of course, they start with Cersei. And there's something so perverse and wonderful about this vengeance goddess walking on water, which I had associated with like Christ and Christianity and other stuff like that. And when Nancy in the craft pulls down the power of Manon and she's all high on that energy, she's walking on water. And it's seriously when I saw it, I was like, it's still the same story being told on some level.
Really powerful magicians walk on water, I guess, is the takeaway from I'm thinking now of all the times that witches, including Christ as a sorcerer, not that Christ is a witch, but it walks on water, right? I'm like, oh, okay,
Well,
we're
that's why they float. They can't drown.
that's true. Finally, before we move on from her famous mythos, and this is one that I'm actually not as familiar with, but I know you are deeply familiar with, is the purification of Medea and Jason after Medea commits murder, right? One of her murders, there's several. Medea is also a favorite classical witch of mine and cousin in some myths to Circe. All myths to Circe, I think. I don't think that's ever disputed that she knows Circe. She's related to her. Slayer, or at least sleeper of dragons. She's a favorite of mine, and I'm wondering if you can talk about, because I in discussing it, I never really understood why it was important for her to pr ritually prepare her and Jason in the way that she, it is very interesting, right? Because she is this evil sorceress that gets banished off to the island of Aea, as your punishment, but also like, no, I will still ritually purify you in the way that it is said that we have to do this if you have murdered somebody. And I was wondering if you could go into that and also talk about how that relates to your witchcraft.
In a very big way, it does. So this positions Circe as an original curse breaker. There's an implication here, and I think the aphorism, even though it's a bit corny, is true. The witch that cannot hex cannot heal is Circe. She curses Odysseus' men, turns them into pigs, but she can turn them back again. She can take the curse off. She can reverse this. What happens with her and Medea is so fascinating because Ovid's description of Medea, if you haven't read it, I don't know it by heart, but it's fantastic. I can get it out to you. Is Medea can do all this stuff. She can like make rivers go backwards. She can cause mountains to crumble. She can all this stuff. She's basically a goddess on some level. But when she's in trouble, and when she has heavy miasma on her and Jason have stolen the Golden Fleece. They've murdered, and it looks like the Furies are going to come get them because they've created sins that were like punishable by the deities at the time. And it's so fascinating to think that even though she's so powerful, when she's really in trouble, when she really fucks up, she has to go to Aiaia. She has to go to Circe for help. Circe is the one that can get me out of this. And that positions Circe as this like unconditional savioress. And that's not a different function than what professional witches are doing. Like when I'm at the Cauldron Black, anyone can walk in. Some people walk in and like just cry the whole time they're sitting with me. Like, you know, they're coming in with heavy miasma. They've done stuff that's been done to them. They have worries, but like, it's just unconditional. It's like, how can I help you on some level? I'm not saying, oh, I won't help you because you did X, Y, and Z. So that's fascinating to think about. She purifies them through some ritual action. We have almost no artwork of it. There's like one carving, if you go to my Instagram, of the three of them in front of like an altar and Jason kneeling. And she purifies them by slaughtering a piglet and taking the blood of the piglet and putting it over them. So again, the purifying pig is still part of this narrative. But the action of lifting miasma, the action of curse breaking, is still practiced in modern Greek culture. Like I said, my grandmother removes the evil eye. That's not a prayer that comes from the Greek Orthodox Church. It's a subversive prayer. But the function of my grandmother taking calls from Greece still to this day in her 90s to remove the evil eye is Circe. It's still like, I can't get this thing off of me by myself. Someone else has more powerful than me has to help.
I'm really curious, and you don't have to say, but I'm wondering, does your, just because of the amount of evil eye removal that I have done, that also says take a pork chop and rub it on somebody, like a raw pork chop. Also too, Marshall has a story about bacon. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if she uses, pork to do it. At least in some cases, maybe not in every case, but I'm wondering.
She doesn't. In fact, I've never heard of that in Greek culture. In the Greek ingredients, the standard ingredients are olive oil, has to be Greek olive oil, for my grandmother has to be from the Kalamata region for other reasons, and water, usually tap water. But notice the plant material is there.
Yes.
It's like still there.
Very interesting. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm just wondering because like in some cases, the herbs, yes, the oil, yes, the water, and yes to a candle, right? At least for me. But in some cases I've had like, yeah, you need to take like, I also eat a lot of pork, so it's something that I have around relatively often. But it's like, rub a piece of pork and go nail it somewhere, is definitely a thing for me.
I mean, that's fascinating. I've actually never come across that folklore, but that is what she does with Jason and Medea. It's implied that she pours the blood over them and then, mm-hmm. you know, you cook the pork and you eat it. That's what would have happened.
Interesting. Thank you.
That is, I never made that connection with my grandmother. She would, when I was younger and they lived on this land out in Texas, I got this horrible splinter in my finger and she said, come here. And she put a raw chunk of bacon over it and then put the Band-Aid over it and said that it would pull the impurity out. And I mean, I was very young. I have this very limited memory and I remember that the splinter came out, but it was just one of those things that I promise you, my mom never did.
Yeah. That's fascinating. It's part of the role of the xematisma process, evil eye removal, is removing bad arrows. So it's like it's taking the miasma out, like you're taking barbed, you know, hooks out of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me think of not only just like concepts of course, fairy shot, elf shot, that gets, you know, recorded later on by the Romans and other people is like perpetuating this idea that it's shot, right? But also to the implication of the term hecateos, right? Far working, darting, a lot of the epithets that get applied to a myriad of deities that I'm thinking of, especially ones that work magic. So therefore, Kirke, Apollo, Hecate, all of these epithets that get put onto them as those who have the ability to work from far away. But there's this implication of like, you shoot darts. And I think that's really interesting. You just put that little thought in my head. I love that. Yeah. Splinters. Magic, evil magic splinters.
Exactly it. And I didn't say this before, but it's important to preface for people who don't know that the word kirki in Greek means circle, and it means hawk, like the bird of prey, because a hawk circles, and it also means ring, like they wear on your finger. So if you think about all the witchcraft implications of circle and ring and birds of prey, it's all implied in just the kirki. Like the word kirki almost sounds like the noise a Greek hawk makes. So the circle of protection, when they go to kirki, they're going to the circle to be protected. Well, also, like, she's the daughter of the sun. And the older mythology of the region, the sun god of the ancient Egyptian pantheon also had daughters and sons. And those daughters and sons are associated with both lions and birds of prey. Mm. And seriously, like a perverted blend of them, right? So if Sekhmet, Hathor, Bast, if that's the lion part, the feline part, Horus is the falcon-headed god. So if you put them together in the same scenery, there's this like male, female, trans, like she's them at the same time. She's always flanked by lions. I should say that, right? All of these modern artwork, ancient artwork, yeah. Implied, these lions are there. It's one of the things that is haunting about the experience for the men approaching her, Odysseus's men, is that these wild, ferocious, extremely dangerous animals are tame around her. They're at ease, even with the men.
That's very exciting. Yeah, the one, I can't remember, but there's a specific image that comes to mind, and I can't remember who it's by, but like she has like leopards, I think, and lions laying around her, which I absolutely
and that love. makes her Potnia Theon. Have you heard this before? It's an epithet that gets thrown around for a bunch of different goddesses. It means Lady of the Beasts. And if you want to go down a very, very deep rabbit hole, the concept of a trans human animal goddess surrounded by a retinue of goddesses is like tens of thousands of years old. Have you seen the film, the documentary film, Cave of Forgotten Dreams?
Mm-mm. No.
That you should put that on the list if we're all going to watch some stuff. Because Cave of Forgotten Dreams is a documentary about the oldest human artwork in a cave in France.
Yes.
And maybe I won't give any spoiler away, but it's connected to this discussion of the Lady of the Beasts. And some of the paintings are 40,000 years old, the markings.
Yes, wow. I remember. I know the cave painting you're talking about. Actually, a more recent discovery came up in this island, I think, in south someplace in the southern hemisphere, maybe, if I remember. I feel like it's by like Tahiti, but I could be making that up. They found a relatively an even older cave painting, but at the time, yes, the French, the one in France, was the oldest one in the world. I remember that.
Wow. So slight change of topic, obviously still centralizing, but you mentioned earlier about talking about Titania Circe. And then you made a slight suggestion that it connects to Shakespeare. I was curious, can you tell us about Titania Circe as a force of witchcraft itself? I'd love to hear about more of your thoughts on that.
So Titania Circe, or putting those two epithets together for me, was something that...
would you call that a synchronization or a synchronization?
There's not quite. Her. And this is not an original idea of mine. I have another prop that I'm going to show you because if folks are really interested...
I love it.
I love that you came with things ready to show and tell. Yeah.
Because, you know, I should just write a book, but instead I have all this research. So this is the Transformations of Circe, Judith Yarnall. So
That painting.
Yeah. I mean, this, again, iconic. You see Odysseus in the background and she's flanked by lions. She's got the wand. She's got the cup. She's the original wand wielding witch. She did it first. It's not just theorized by me that Titania is very on purpose Circe. She's Circe stripped of her power. And it's a very interesting thing that happens in Elizabethan time that was entertaining to see her in this kind of humiliated form. But it is Circe. Titania just means literally daughter of Titans. So it's an epithet that can go for, yeah, it just means daughter of Titans. He's doing it very on purpose. So they sort of merged in my mind in the 1980s when Titania Circe became sort of my main go-to, for lack of a better term, spirit guide. I don't know what to call her. So in 2018, Matthew Venus of Spiritus Arcanum and Jackie Aloisi of The Cauldron Black were starting to talk about this Salem Witchcraft and Folklore Festival. And people were proposing doing different stuff. And one of the things we planned to do there was have a night of magical activism inside of the Witch House, which is the oldest, it's the building connected to the witch trials that exists in the actual city of Salem right now. And I proposed to do an invocation to Titania Searcy to call her forth as a spiritual force for modern witchcraft, as like a sageress, and all the things we discussed as a curse breaker, as an ally, as a, you know, a pharmaki, as all of that stuff, as healer. As transmutational protective energy, essentially. And so I started a ritual process, which I haven't even taught the Searcy Academy kids this yet, but it was a long process. It involved plant material and animal material and raising a few generations of Polyphemus moths, because Polyphemus is in the Odyssey, and that's who Odysseus's men encounter Polyphemus before they encounter Circe. So there's an interesting thing that happened there with me and them. And I did the ritual. It was a chanted guided ritual. There were three sets of groups that came in because of the size of the festival and the size of the venue. And I didn't know what to expect. It was experimental magic. I did it as, I called it the Exaltation of Titania, as a reference to the Exaltation of Inanna by Anhedwana. And that original text, Anhedwana's text, was to get the goddess Inanna to save Anhedwana and her family from ruin and probably from the battles of war. And I didn't know what would happen. I didn't know if anyone would feel anything. I didn't know like if it would be successful or whatever, but I was just like, I'll just do it. I'll enjoy it if no one else does. So I did it, and we all chanted together. It was sort of guided lightly, and people were coming up to me afterwards and were like, what the fuck was that? You know, some of our esteemed colleagues, I think you won't mind me mentioning him by name, but Professor Charles Porterfield, who I hadn't met. I had only known him peripherally. Came up to me at the end of this, one of the ceremonies, when I'm already in this very unusual trance state, and said, can I speak to her directly? And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, can I speak to her? Could you picture it?
The way that I can see Charles in my head now doing that. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. It was like he was ablaze with this prophetic energy. Can you speak to her directly? And not smiling, I was like, yes. And he proceeded, I won't tell you what he said, but he proceeded to speak to Titania Searcy that he felt was present with me. And that someone coming from like completely different cultural context, feeling something, being that connected, I was like, okay, I have to do this thing. And so Titania Searcy is now the patroness of Searcy Academy. She's our main go-to spirit ally, titanic force goddess, whatever you want to call her. And this is maybe a version of her that is unique to what I'm doing. And I think it's important to presence that, like, if people are out there working with Circe or worshiping Circe or whatever they're doing, they might not be interacting with Titania Circe the way I'm interacting with Titania Circe, but everyone is invited, because this was a process of witchcraft activism. This was magical activism. So she is an unconditional sageress, curse breaker, ally. You know, I think it's important for me to presence that I don't think that I own her or anything like that. That my hope with Circe Academy is that the devotional study and practice continues. We're doing like an entire Circe Wheel of the Year, and we just keep doing the same thing over and over again. So I guess the answer to who is Titania Searcy, for me, I guess if it's specific and unique, she is the queer, transmutational, protective energy of witchcraft activism in particular. Because you see that Searcy is sort of an activist, right? Mm-hmm. The original source material. She takes in the beaten up men of Odysseus. She takes care of them. She heals them. She takes in Medea and Jason when they've really fucked up. She is in that role of unusual queer, maybe, but unconditional savioress. That makes sense?
It does. And you know, I'm listening to all of this, and it's such an amazing thing. Like, I know part of my own journey has been expanding my experience in the craft and learning so much more than what you can get in a traditional Witchcraft 101 book. But it's very interesting. I feel like I meet a lot of new practitioners a lot of times who will hear what you're talking about right near and have no idea that this is even something they can do. Like, I feel like I know I grew up, I was born in the 80s, grew up in the 90s, and so much of my exposure to witchcraft was extremely narrow. It was a very much, these are the four elements, there's a lord and the lady, there's a lot of things that are obviously bigger than that. But now you're talking about Titania Circe, you're talking about a titan ass, and you're talking about a savior ass, and you're talking about lore that is so outside of this necessary, like, traditional narrow path that I think that so many people are just not getting exposure to because they don't have as much resources, or maybe they're just still so new or only understanding so much. I think that's something that is really expanding or has been expanding my awareness a lot over the last few years. And I don't know. I'm really excited for listeners to hear this, to learn about, like, your, but we're going to also ask about Circe Academy, of course, too. But, like, there are so many bigger things out there and possibilities in witchcraft than what we may realize is right in front of our fingertips. But it's probably going to be a little bit bigger than just getting your Witchcraft 101 book at Barnes and Noble.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And I was that person. You know, my
I was
mom, like,
too.
you know what I mean? Like, my mom, you know, took me to Laurie Cabot. She's like, "Do you want to study with her?" And I was like, "No, not really." You know, and something, it's not a criticism of her by any means,
No,
but
no.
like, as a queer kid in the 80s, and seeing these very binary, here's the male god, here's the divine feminine, everything's about straight people fucking ultimately. Like, I was like, that's not it. For me, it's never going to be it for me. But the interesting paradox, I think, is that I think when people think about why they're interested in witchcraft, truly, when they think about what they actually conceive witchcraft to be, Circe's already in their ideas. She has this weird paradox of like being camouflaged. It's like she's invisible. Like, but she's in your life already. Like, if you even are interested in witchcraft, and in the Book of Oberon, which I know you're a fan of, Austin, there's a the Queen of Fairies can be summoned to gift a ring, like a ring that you wear, of invisibility. But that old English word can be translated as invisibility or invincibility. Like, and it's very like Tolkien, like the One Ring, like they put them on and they disappear. Like there's something about her being there because she's so pervasive and so powerful and so generous with the power that you don't even perceive that she's there.
I
That's the
love,
queerness.
absolutely, and I love the Book of Oberyn, and also hate it at the same time. It's a great book. It's also like, just call a spirit. I don't know why you need to go through these 40,000 steps, but you know, the English were weird about what they wrote, in terms of magic. Anyways, but it also coming up at the same time as Shakespeare's writing his plays about so many fairies and Titania being a fairy queen, right? At least one of them that he names, as well as Sibylla, as well as Mab. But I know that Titania, and then you placing this, and this isn't necessarily a new concept too, but that either a lot of sorceresses get kind of amalgamed into these fairy queens in middle Renaissance, early modern English, not only just in the plays, but also as we can see by the Book of Oberyn being a textbook of magic, also in ritual magic too. So it's not just like, oh, Oberyn's just a Shakespearean play character, obviously, and he's pulling it, you know, from folk tales too. But there's also magic that can be worked in there as well, and I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, me too. And I think it's right over my shoulder. So sit right here, the green cover.
Yes.
That's great.
Before we go into your work at the Circe Academy too, I want to talk about how Kirke shows up for you in your yogic and your sorceress practices as well. A while ago, you talked about witchcraft yoga, and you were kind of teaching some classes on that. And this is like when we first not even I don't even think we had any interactions before. And I'll be so honest, when I see like witchcraft and yoga put together, my immediate reaction is like, that's very interesting. Let's see, like is it going to be the Yoruba chakra, Orisha, chakras or things like that, and we won't go there. But honestly, like, of course, getting to know you and knowing your work and your background in the multiple initiations that you've had within yoga as well as Tibetan Buddhism and things like that, I was wondering if you could also talk about like witchcraft yoga and why you chose to name it that and how that also shows up for you. Because I know for you it shows up in so many different ways, and even in like pop culture media that like you can see that showing through, because we've talked about it before. But yeah, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I do. And I guess I have to, I'm trying not to make this a really long story, but I guess I have to say that yoga was also already there. So my mom and my aunts were doing yoga and practicing witchcraft. And I think that's important to presence. This was the 60s, right? So you can't really separate yoga and meditation, Buddhism, Hinduism from modern witchcraft for a variety of reasons. We can blame Blavatsky or Crowley, but it's there. Like, even if it was appropriated and misunderstood and whatever, I'm not going to get into their intentions around it. It's still there. And a lot of yoga, and when I say yoga, I don't mean modern mainstream yoga. The original source material texts of yoga are extremely witchy, like extremely witchy. So most people who get a yoga certification to teach, this was my what I did for a long time. I taught yoga teachers to teach. We'll study a few texts, and what most unfortunately Westerners promote is Patanjali, because Patanjali was an atheist at the time. So he didn't believe in God in the sense of like a creator and a son and a savior and all that stuff that that most people who were studying were believing. And I mean modern studiers or yoga. But his instructions were to gain miracle powers. Well, that's what they're called in the ancient texts. And the practitioner achieves a godlike state. And he describes, if you do this right, you'll be able to, guess what? Walk on water, change your shape, like do all kinds of crazy shit, fly through the air, like control fire, go to other dimensions. It's all like witch power. And that Patanjali was writing based on much older stuff, because he was getting information from Buddha's original stuff. So, and Buddha was getting stuff from the Rig Veda. So like it keeps going back and back and back and back. But a lot of even Buddha's instruction are like, if you do this and the deity comes and enters your body, literally, that's what most Mahayana centered Buddhists are doing, invoking a deity into their body and integrating the spirit of that deity with their chakra system. The main Sushumna line, which is like the host of the chakra systems, is a straw. It's a straw-like structure, and the energy of the deity goes into the straw and then goes through your body. And it's supposed to give you miracle powers, and you'll be able to heal people. And this is like Buddha said all this stuff. It's extremely witchy. And I think most of the sort of superpowers that we assume come from pop culture were being talked about for tens of thousands of years, you know, and people believed them that if you could just get this to this level of meditative equipoise, you'll be able to be like a god in a human body. And
I
that's like
mean,
quote ancient texts.
I think you and I maybe at one point or another have seen some very like one of the ways to know that a spirit is there, right? When spirits enter the body is in some cases do something miraculous. And so they will do something miraculous, whether it be healing, whether it be I don't know why, but like my Instagram algorithm right now is set up to show like devotive Hinduistic possession where like Kali will come down and they'll be like eating fire and stuff like that. I don't know why right now my algorithm is set up for that, but of course I'm like, okay, obviously this is to get an attention grab for people. But the reality of like spirits coming down and walking on coals, doing the fire walks, the fire dances, eating fire, eating glass, things like that, to oftentimes to show non-believers who may even secretly be in the room, which I always think that's really funny, is when this a spirit, it doesn't even have to be a deity sometimes, but when a spirit comes down and does something really fucked up to, and then we'll call the person out who's sitting, maybe they'll sit in the back of the room if you're imagining this as like a circle of people, right? And the spirit will come down and be like, you don't believe in what this is, you don't believe in this fully, I'll show you right now. And then they'll do something seemingly awful, but then when they leave, the person's fine. And that's always really interesting to me. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, I mean the yoga mechanics, like the idea of like there's an energy body and that energy body can interact with other energy bodies, and we're not these autonomous, this is the boundary of me and this is the boundary of you, that we can actually blend and be the transhuman deity like hybrids, is very Mahayana tantric Buddhist. I mean, one of the reasons I ordained in the order that I ordained in is like they were doing spirit possession. A Buddha called a Dharmapala, a Dharma protector, comes into the body of the practitioner, and when you see that happen, you can't unsee that. Like I was in a room of like 12 people, and I was like, everyone was like, what the fuck just happened? Like it was like blowing up a balloon. This old Tibetan monk who was like in his 80s did some chanting, rang a bell, and then suddenly he was like a different thing speaking to us, And they test them. There's a lot of videos. They'll put like hundreds of pounds of armor on these old 80-year-old monks, and they'll be swinging a sword around that weighs 300 pounds that like 40 other monks have to like carry. It's wild stuff. So tantric yoga mechanics already has the blueprint for spirit possession, spirit flight, clairvoyance, miracle powers. It already has all that stuff. And so it trickled its way into modern mainstream Wicca and witchcraft and stuff like that. So it's already there. So when you shine a light on it with someone who actually has initiations and has studied, it's like, oh, you can see how like even like I'm thinking about Dune, not Twink Dune, but Frank Herbert's Dune. The Bene Gesserit have a system of magic that's called Pranabindu. That's yoga. Prana means energy, bindu means point of focus. All the yogic sadhanas of Mahayana tantric Buddhism follow that formula, that you're taking energy to a point of focus, prana bindu. So for when I teach any class, we start with what I call ancestral portal yoga. And all ancestral portal yoga does is it aligns the practitioner to the titanic forces that they're already in the continuum of. Like it acknowledges that, like, yeah, I might look like an individual sitting here and talking, but I'm in the continuum of the primordial protective energy that comes up from the planet below me. I'm in the continuum of the solar energy that gave life to this world. I'm in the continuum of the intergalactic winds that brought the carbon particles to this world system that are now my body that's making the noise that's coming out of my voice. But when I acknowledge it, it puts a magnifying glass on it, and that's a bindu. So the awareness, drishti, causes this magnifying property, which ignites power in the body. So I've just applied all that technique to witchcraft, to casting spells, to like, I don't know, gaining clairvoyance. All of that stuff is included in what we do in the Tipsy Academy.
Right. The witch will take whatever power she can and put it in her tool bag.
You know, they never told me any of that at my local YMCA Payo
They're not going
class.
to do that.
Never mentioned it once. They told me to bring a pillow.
That's the thing. It's so watered down, and it's fine. It's beneficial for people. I taught mainstream. I mean, I don't often talk about stuff like this because I'm Gen X, and I cringe that I'm even going to say this. But I was like teaching professional athletes, and there were famous people in my classes, And it benefited them to just do this very physical yoga. They were physically stronger. They were clearer mentally. Things seemed to go their way. But I never said to them, it's because you're achieving miracle powers. But on some level, it's because the techniques make you like a demigod. They make you a little bit stronger than human.
All the wellness brand of like tantric things and yoga and so on and so forth. And then it's really interesting because then you find out that Tantra is absolutely a sorceress tradition that isn't necessarily just about being horny and building your tantric power into your yoni or whatever. You know, it goes farther than that. And has very interesting sorceress capabilities to it. And I find all that very interesting. Is like the West really loves a watered down fetishization of a concept like the mandrake.
But similar to like the Facebook group, you know, get a bundle of lavender and put it in your pocket, like is a reference to Circe. It works because of the belief, because of the focus, because of maybe their own spirits. It works. The same thing happens in a modern yoga class where it can be so watered down, you have no idea it's actually rooted in 10,000-year-old folklore, but it does something to you. You do feel physically better. You do feel mentally clearer. You do sleep better because it's doing stuff on that like mechanical level almost with the energy body.
For sure. I want to talk about before we close out our mythical place, our magical place of the dream world of the island of Vaiea. And I know that you've talked about it in your classes. I know that we've talked about it in the podcast as being this. It's interesting because even the way that it's talked about in the Odyssey is almost like this liminal place that's in and out of time. The island moves depending on the myth, of course, by proxy of myth making, they'll place the island wherever they want to. But it's very interesting to me is this the island of Aiea as the home of Kirki, if for those who aren't familiar with what I'm talking about. But is also being the place I've went there, you know, in vision and journeying and things like that, as a place to meet with other spirits, not even necessarily just Circe, but also harpies, particularly is one of the most prominent ones, as these spirits of wind that like circle the island, right? And I'm wondering if you could talk about the island of Aiea, why it's important for you, why it can be a place outside of reality, but also in reality, and so on and so forth.
I can. And I just want to present again that a lot of my ideas are not original. So Judith Yonner talks about this, that this space that, you know, Odysseus and his men, they can't set out to find Aiea. They only happen upon it because they're lost. And that's an important moment. There's loss, desperation, nowhere else to turn. And when you think about how witchcraft functions, it's often the downtrodden. It's often the people that have no other option. It's like, this has to work. It's Nancy from the craft. This has to work. I can't live like this anymore. And it does. So there's something about the desperation and that reaching out to that other place, you know, the other realm, the world between the worlds, or the space between the worlds, as Starhawk would call it. That allows for magic to work. And I think there's something psychological that happens. No big surprise. It's very similar in Mahayana Tantric Buddhism. You know, in the initiations that I have, I can't tell you too much about that stuff, but basically this is across the board in multiple initiatory lineages. The practitioner first, when they're working with the deity, they do go through a bunch of steps, which are a lot like necromancy. They call up all the previous lineage gurus and they go all the way back to the original if they can. And then they empower themselves. But the way they empower themselves is they disappear the whole world. You imagine the whole world disappears and that you appear in this pure land, a world that's beyond our world. And that's where the magic works. So it's like Aiea. That's where magic works. It's where magic exists. That's where the roots are. And that's where, you know, the Potnia Theron, the Lady of the Beasts, you know, the witch and her familiars are. The witch flanked by, why are these lions and tigers so familiar with her? Why are they so nice to her? It's that place where these spirits of plants and hybrids and humans all are sort of interacting together. And we do that as a spirit flight in Circe Academy when we do any kind of magical work and we go to Ayaya. That was also a part of my exaltation of Titania. We just chanted the word Ayaya in a stylized way to induce trance, to open our eyes on that space. And I think that theme of, if you go to this other place, that's where the magic can happen, is Circe. She's the original source material. Like we can't separate it because it travels all the way through Europe into the, you know, it comes to us as a modern version, but it starts with her on some level.
Everything you were just describing, and even the way you were asking the question, Austin, it was just like, this is giving me spirit flight. This is giving me flying to the Sabbath. This is a sabbatic, trance-like soul flight. And it's so fascinating. We just did an episode on chaos magic with Ivy the Occultist, and I talked about my experience of creating this, like what I talk about going to my astral temple when I am kind of going into a trance state, phasing out. It's like the whole world disappears, and instead I'm going to this very different place where this is the place that I go to meet my familiars. This is literally word for word what I said just 2 weeks ago. This is a place that I meet my familiars. This is a place where I have my own private altar with my own tools in my own space. And while, yes, I am sitting at my altar in my bedroom, this is also where I am with a completely split awareness. And she calls it her mind palace. And there was a whole nother conversation around that. But it was very much what you're talking about right now. And there is a place that I feel like, again, I think when I first got into soul flight in the first place, I think I really drastically misunderstood. I kept waiting for a visual interpretation, like I was living through a movie experience of looking down, waving goodbye to my body and saying, whoop, there go into the night. It's not quite that same sort of experience. It's a very, very different. Now, if that's someone else's, please don't let me take that away from you. But it is a trance-like experience that I go to this place. And what you're describing right now feels so in line with what I've experienced as well. And again, I'm still so new to Circe as an inspiration, but it's like you said, she's been there all along.
It's so fascinating because not only is it very Circe, if we break down what the, you know, modern definition of witchcraft is, or I think what it should be, mm-hmm. it's spirit flight, working with spirit familiars, Circe, working with plant material, Circe, cursing, Circe, curse breaking, Circe. Like anything that's out there is already, it's originating with her. And I think that means that she's already there. It's like she's this titanic force of witchcraft itself. When we talk about Kirikian witchcraft, it's like a play on words because it's redundant. It's witchcraft. It's the same, you know, she's already a part of so many people's practice. And it doesn't matter that you don't even realize it. It still works on some level.
It does. So before we wrap up, I really want to talk about Circe Academy. This is a school that you have put together. You have lots of online classes already. You also do this class, from what I understand, out of the Cauldron Black up in Salem, Massachusetts. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, so after the Exaltation of Titania, I was basically getting all these questions. How do I work with Circe? What's the herb correspondences with Circe? And I was like, it's more complicated than that. And then every time I started saying it's more complicated, that like another class would come out or another course would come out. And now it's turned into a year-long curriculum. And what we do is we celebrate these different powers, spirit flight, pharmakia, transmutation on the wheel of the year. For example, on the 30th is Witch's Eve. So can you imagine that the spirit flight is the power that's the lore and of the European of Witch's Night is that they're flying and cursing everybody. So we lean into that lore and we've designed a class around spirit flight and empowering our spirit flight tools. And how would Circe do it, basically? And how would Titania Circe empower what we do? And I cover everything. I mean, everything that I think is essential: necromancy, shape-shifting, divination. It is ongoing, which means you can drop into any point of it and study for the whole year. We circle around again. And what we're finding, the paradox is for me, is that I'm also learning. Like at first I was like, this is me and it's my baby. And now I'm like, I'm also like a student in the process, it seems like. So Titania Searcy has a statue that is in the Cauldron Black. So she's a part of the spirit retinue of the Cauldron Black. And really, Searcy Academy is my collaboration with the Cauldron Black. It's a response to, you know, after I started teaching there and giving readings there, it's mainly a response to like, well, how do I do this with Searcy? Or what's a good way to empower plant material? What's a good way to work with plant allies? It's been in response to like what I feel like is missing in modern. I try to not be redundant. Like other people have done other stuff. As far as I know, the only school of devotion to Circe as a witchcraft goddess. And everyone's welcome. Like, even if you're newer to the craft, even if you already have commitments and initiations in other places, it doesn't negate any of that. And we don't turn anyone away. We are working on a nonprofit status called the Chapel of Maria Padilla, which will be a religious organization. So anyone who is experiencing like financial difficulty, we have possible scholarships. You can come in and pay it by what you can, because the heart of it is Titania Searcy, which is witchcraft activism, and that includes, of course, education, because Searcy is an educator of Odysseus. I guess it's important for me to say that here, that the first recorded in writing example of necromantic instruction is Circe telling Odysseus how to raise the dead. And she gives him very specific instructions. Go to a certain place, dig a pit this big, pour honey and milk around, sacrifice this animal, and then this will happen. So she is an instructor. She's the first person to do that. So that was the inspiration for making this sort of educational, but also like a community service, something that everyone can participate in. Does that make sense? Did I forget anything?
No, that was a beautiful explanation. And it's also reminded me that there are a lot of things about this story and history mythology that I have completely forgotten.
And that is interesting for a variety of reasons, because one of the signs in British Isles folklore that you're interacting with a fairy is they can affect your memory.
And you know what? So, I interact with a lot of fairies.
There's something there. There's something around her being present, being camouflaged, being invisible, and like and disappearing, coming in and out of importance. And it feels like for whatever reason now, with Tashen and Madeline Miller, and I think there's even going to be a TV show that's coming out from Madeline Miller's book. Yeah, that Circe is like, it's all happened recently in the past.
Yes. The rise of Titania Searcy. I love this. Nick, thank you so much for being here today. This has been so educational. I've always been a little bit more quiet because I just have been loved listening to everything that you have to say. I've learned a lot. Obviously, I'm going to walk away feeling a little bit more expanded on Searcy beyond Bernadette Peters and being taken to bed, but it makes me want to go rewatch Odysseus now, because I swear, if anyone hasn't seen this, first off, you've got to go find it somewhere. I mean, like I said, Bernadette Peters. There was Athena was played by Isabel Rossellini.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, it was just a barrage of gorgeousness. So, anyways, I'm on a tangent again, but thank you so much for being here. This has been an amazing episode. I can't wait to get it out to people.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. It was lovely, as you can tell. I'm excited to talk about it. I could talk about it for hours. It's been a pleasure.
Perfect. You've been listening to Southern Bramble, a podcast of Crooked Ways. I'm Marshall, Witch of Southern Light. You can find me on Instagram, Threads, TikTok at Witch of Southern Light. You can buy my book, Cunning Words, A Grimoire of Tales and Magic, on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. If you are an occult shop and you'd like to carry my book, please check it out on Ingram Spark, the catalog. And If you'd like to buy my art, yes, you can find that on Redbubble and even some grimoire pages on Etsy. All of those links are in the bio of my page. Austin, take it away.
And I'm Austin Bain X Bramble on Instagram. You can shop all my womanly wares at BaneXBramble.com, where you can find perfumes, incense, oils, and other magical formulas, as well as look into my divination services of geomancy, tarot, and I will be doing a special service for Rosalia in June that is developing a personalized perfume from aspects in your own natal chart. So be on the lookout for that. Nick, thank you so much for being here. Where can everybody find you?
The easiest place for people to find me, I think, is on Instagram. That's where I'm most active. I'm at Urban Wizard. Of course, I'm at the Cauldron Black. You can book in-person and remote stuff with me. It doesn't have to just be psychic readings, but I give psychic readings. It can be ritual work, one-on-one time, ask me anything kind of stuff. And I have a Patreon I should promote called Hedgecraft Ritual Arts. Hedgecraft because it is hedge crossing. It's the main thing that we do. I teach people how to craft rituals that allow them to cross this barrier between, our reality and that other place in order to do magic. And enrolling in Patreon also enrolls you in my curse breaking service. So I do two curse breaking Greek somatisma, Greek and tantric yoga somatisma, twice a day. I do one under the sun and one under the stars for everyone who enrolls on Patreon. So it's a general sort of like a non-invasive psychic energetic procedure that removes at least a superficial layer of any like magical attack or miasma. Folks, and I go live with Hedgecraft Ritual Arts sometimes as many as two or three times a week on Zoom. So there's a lot of recordings up there as well.
Southern Bramble is a Patreon-supported podcast. We'd like to thank our Patreon supporters by name, Witrafa, V, Tyrone, Tracy, Timothy, The Witch of Patapsco Forest, The Modern Babylon, The Lady Ghost, Shanna, Nico, Lisa, Keith, Key, Johnny, John, Jennifer, Jennifer Squared, Jamisa, Giles, Earl, Callie, Ariella, Addity. Thank you all so much.